Quentin Daniel sat on the floor with his tray on his lap. He seemed completely at home, and he glanced up at her once in a while, grinning like an impudent kid brother who had beaten her to a secret she had not discovered. He had preceded her into the valley by some 10 minutes, she thought. But he was one of them, while she was still a stranger. Galt sat aside, beyond the circle of lamplight, on the arm of Dr. Axton's chair. He had not said a word. He had stepped back and turned her over to the others, and he sat watching it as a spectacle in which he had no further part to play. But her eyes kept coming back to him, drawn by the certainty that the spectacle was of his choice and staging, that he had set it in motion long ago, and that all the others knew it as she knew it. She noticed another person who was intensely aware of Galt's presence. Hugh Axton glanced up at him once in a while, involuntarily, almost surreptitiously, as if struggling not to confess the loneliness of a long separation. Axton did not speak to him, as if taking his presence for granted. But once, when Galt bent forward and a strand of hair fell down across his face, Axton reached over and brushed it back, his hand lingering for an imperceptible instant on his pupil's forehead. It was the only break of emotion he permitted himself, the only greeting. It was the gesture of a father. She found herself talking to the men around her, relaxing in light-hearted comfort. No, she thought. What she felt was not strain. It was a dim astonishment at the strain which she should but did not feel. The abnormality of it was that it seemed so normal and simple. She was barely aware of her questions as she spoke to one man after another, but their answers were printing a record in her mind, moving sentence by sentence to a goal. "The Fifth Concerto?" said Richard Halley in answer to her question. "I wrote it 10 years ago. We call it the Concerto of Deliverance. Thank you for recognizing it from a few notes whistled in the night." "Yes, I know about that." "Yes, since you knew my work, you would know when you heard it that this concerto said everything I had been struggling to say and reach. It's dedicated to him." He pointed to Galt. "Why, no, Miss Taggart, I haven't given up music. What makes you think so? I've written more in the last 10 years than in any other period of my life. I will play it for you, any of it, when you come to my house." "No, Miss Taggart, it will not be published outside. Not a note of it will be heard beyond these mountains." "No, Miss Taggart, I've not given up medicine," said Dr. Hendricks in answer to her question. "I've spent the last 6 years on research. I have discovered a method to protect the blood vessels of the brain from that fatal rupture which is known as a brain stroke. It will remove from human existence the terrible threat of sudden paralysis." "No, not a word of my method will be heard outside." "The law, Miss Taggart," said Judge Narragansett. "What law?" "I did not give it up. It has ceased to exist. But I am still working in the profession I had chosen, which was that of serving the cause of justice." "No, justice has not ceased to exist. How could it? It is possible for men to abandon their sight of it, and then it is justice that destroys them. But it is not possible for justice to go out of existence, because one is an attribute of the other, because justice is the act of acknowledging that which exists. Yes, I am continuing in my profession. I am writing a treatise on the philosophy of law. I shall demonstrate that humanity's darkest evil, the most destructive horror machine among all the devices of men, is non-objective law. No, Miss Taggart, my treatise will not be published outside."
"My business, Miss Taggart," said Midas Mulligan. "My business is blood transfusion, and I'm still doing it. My job is to feed a life fuel into the plants that are capable of growing. But ask Dr. Hendricks whether any amount of blood will save a body that refuses to function, a rotten hulk that expects to exist without effort. My blood bank is gold. Gold is a fuel that will perform wonders. But no fuel can work where there is no motor. No, I haven't given up. I merely got fed up with the job of running a slaughterhouse where one drains blood out of healthy living beings and pumps it into gutless half-corpses."
"Given up?" said Hugh Axton. "Check your premises, Miss Taggart. None of us has given up. It is the world that has. What is wrong with a philosopher running a roadside diner or a cigarette factory as I'm doing now? All work is an act of philosophy, and when men will learn to consider productive work and that which is its source as the standard of their moral values, they will reach that state of perfection which is the birthright they lost. The source of work? Man's mind, Miss Taggart. Man's reasoning mind. I am writing a book on this subject, defining a moral philosophy that I learned from my own pupil. Yes, it could save the world. No, it will not be published outside. Why? She cried. Why? What are you doing, all of you? We are on strike, said John Galt. They all turned to him, as if they'd been waiting for his voice and for that word. She heard the empty beat of time within her, which was the sudden silence of the room as she looked at him across a span of lamplight. He sat slouched casually on the arm of a chair leaning forward, his forearm across his knees, his hand hanging down idly. And it was the faint smile on his face that gave to his words the deadly sound of the irrevocable. Why should this seem so startling? There's only one kind of men who have never been on strike in human history. Every other kind and class have stopped when they so wished, and have presented demands to the world, claiming to be indispensable. Except the men who have carried the world on their shoulders, have kept it alive, have endured torture as sole payment, but have never walked out on the human race. Well, their turn has come. Let the world discover who they are, what they do, and what happens when they refuse to function. This is the strike of the men of the mind, Miss Taggart. This is the mind on strike. She did not move, except for the fingers of one hand that moved slowly up her cheek to her temple. Through all the ages, he said, the mind has been regarded as evil, and every form of insult, from heretic to materialist to exploiter, every form of iniquity, from exile to disenfranchisement to expropriation, every form of torture, from sneers to rack to firing squad, have been brought down upon those who assume the responsibility of looking at the world through the eyes of a living consciousness, and performing the crucial act of a rational connection. Yet only to the extent to which, in chains, in dungeons, in hidden corners, in the cells of philosophers, in the shops of traders, some men continued to think, only to that extent was humanity able to survive. Through all the centuries of the worship of the mindless, whatever stagnation humanity chose to endure, whatever brutality to practice, it was only by the grace of the men who perceived that wheat must have water in order to grow, that stones laid in a curve will form an arch, that two and two makes four, that love is not served by torture and life is not fed by destruction. Only by the grace of those men did the rest of them learn to experience moments when they caught the spark of being human, and only the sum of such moments permitted them to continue to exist. It was the man of the mind who taught them to bake their bread, to heal their wounds, to forge their weapons, and to build the jails into which they threw him. He was the man of extravagant energy and reckless generosity, who knew that stagnation is not man's fate, that impotence is not his nature, that the ingenuity of his mind is his noblest and most joyous power. And in service to that love of existence he was alone to feel, he went on working, working at any price, working for his despoilers, for his jailers, for his torturers, paying with his life for the privilege of saving theirs. This was his glory and his guilt, that he let them teach him to feel guilty of his glory, to accept the part of a sacrificial animal, and in punishment for the sin of intelligence to perish on the altars of the brutes. The tragic joke of human history is that on any of the altars men erected, it was always man whom they immolated, and the animal whom they enshrined. It was always the animal's attributes, not man's, that humanity worshipped, the idol of instinct and the idol of force, the mystics and the kings. The mystics, who longed for an irresponsible consciousness and ruled by means of the claim that their dark emotions were superior to reason, that knowledge came in blind, causeless fits, blindly to be followed, not doubted, and the kings, who ruled by means of claws and muscles, with conquest as their method and looting as their aim, with a club or a gun as sole sanction of their power. The defenders of man's soul were concerned with his feelings, and the defenders of man's body were concerned with his stomach, but both were united against his mind. Yet no one, not the lowest of humans, is ever able fully to renounce his brain. No one has ever believed in the irrational. What they do believe in is the unjust. Whenever a man denounces the mind, it is because his goal is of a nature the mind would not permit him to confess. When he preaches contradictions, he does so in the knowledge that someone will accept the burden of the impossible. Someone will make it work for him at the price of his own suffering or life. Destruction is the price of any contradiction. It is the victims who made injustice possible. It is the men of reason who made it possible for the rule of the brute to work. The despoiling of reason has been the motive of every anti-reason creed on earth. The despoiling of ability has been the purpose of every creed that preached self-sacrifice. The despoilers have always known it. We haven't. The time has come for us to see.